Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to Community Radio KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM. And this is a flash interview. We don't normally do these, but we have a special reason because the Cordilleran and Rocky Mountain section of the Geological Society of America is in town. They're having their section meeting. I'm Laura Ackerman of Earth Matters Now. I have been covering the section meeting. We're going to have Nick Zentner on tomorrow at noon as a special guest for about an hour. And today I'm having a lot of students come in who are at the section meeting. And the first person I'm interviewing, and I'll be here until four, the first person that I am interviewing is Julia Lee Bridgewater. Julia Lee. She is from Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. Julia, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So where in Massachusetts are you from?
So I am actually from Walpole, Massachusetts, which is a little town kind of south of Boston. If you are a Patriots fan, it's right next to Gillette Stadium where the Patriots play.
Okay. I'm sure there are some Patriots fans in Spokane. And so what year are you in college?
I'm a senior. I'm actually going to be graduating early next December. So I will be finishing, I start next semester in August, and then I will be finished with all my school next semester at the end of December.
What's your major?
I am an environmental geoscience major.
Okay, well, tell us about environmental geoscience.
So it's a really nice mixture of getting an education in geology as well as environmental backgrounds. So you take your standard geology courses such as geomorphology, mineralogy, petrology, but then you also have a lot of different courses that focus on environmental problems, like hydrology is a big one that we do. Geodynamics is another one where we touch base on a lot of environmental issues.
And do you have any particular place that you would like to work after you have graduated?
So I love you know, out west, but I'm very partial to New England. I've been in New England my whole life, but I really do love it out here. So if I could work anywhere, I'd probably either say working up in Maine, doing some geology work out there, or out in around Butte, Montana. I really like that area.
That's an interesting place for groundwater.
Yes, definitely. I am very interested in groundwater management. I actually hopefully plan to pursue a master's in geohydrology to specifically work with groundwater contamination.
Yeah, and Butte has a bit of that.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Right, because it's a Superfund site.
Yeah, the Berkeley Pit.
Right, and what kinds of things are in the Berkeley Pit?
Oh, I actually visited there for the first time when I went out to do my field work in Montana. I think they have like chromium, cadmium, whatever heavy metals they have.
Yeah, it's all from, was it copper mining?
I believe so.
Right. So how did you find out about the section meeting here? And I'm assuming because you did field work in Butte, that's part of the Rocky Mountains. So that's why you're at this section meeting.
Yeah, my field work was in the Ruby Range, which is kind of near Dillon, Montana. So I'm from New England and we did our work out there. So if we went to the GSA conference in New England, I don't think it would have as big of an impact. So our school sent us out here to, present our research in an area where, you know, people know where the rubies are and kind of what geological things are happening out there.
What did you like about the Ruby Mountains?
Well, it's like no other.
It's more like what you didn't like everything.
Oh, I liked everything. People always get mad at me for saying this, but we did our field work and then we went to Yellowstone, and I will arguably say I think the rubies are more beautiful than Yellowstone are. It was so beautiful out there. You could see for hundreds of miles. The lupine flowers were just, you know, beautiful. The smell of sagebrush was just amazing. It was an unreal experience, and it's something that sticks in my mind even now when I think about it. It's just so beautiful out there.
So what kind of research did you do in the rubies then?
So originally, I actually went out to look for these another type of ultramafic rocks, diabase. But unfortunately, we had the geologic maps, but we weren't finding the rocks where they were said to be. So, you know, we checked out one outcrop, which ended up, you know, complete shot in the dark, was a ultramafic form of this rock called a peridotite, which is a rock that originates from the mantle. So, you know, we started thinking, and my professor, who's done a lot of work out there, he had another student that had done work in another part of Montana where they had found similar structures. So he goes, hey, you know, this, you know, we couldn't find what you were originally looking for, but this is really cool. You should take this on and research it. So, you know, we collected samples. We ended up going out on a wild goose chase looking for peridotite samples out in the Ruby Mountains. And we luckily found three outcrops, but we found that. And then we went back to collected samples, went back to Bridgewater. We crushed them and made thin sections out of them and prepared them for geochemical analysis. And a big part of what my project is now is looking at our data and information and looking at the data information of other researchers and trying to figure out if they were tectonically emplaced or intrusive in nature.
Okay, so you'll have to explain those last two terms, tectonically and what was the other one?
Intrusive.
Intrusive. What's the difference between intrusive and tectonic?
So tectonic would be if, you know, you have in geology, you have faulting and, you know, you have folding and it's structural things that happen to the rock. So the one idea is that, you know, there was folding in the in the Ruby Mountains. There was folding, and that folding and faulting during what we think occurred during the Big Sky orogeny, which is an orogeny is a mountain building time, and we think that folding and that, you know, structural behavior just, you know, emplaced these peridotite forms. But we also have the other idea that since it's from the mantle, you know, you see volcanoes and, you know, the lava goes up. Something similar happens, but it's a little bit different. These rocks, you know, either formed in cracks or we kind of like to think that they were like fingers kind of pushing up through the crust. And we think that they might have just intruded directly upwards or through a fault. And they were originally a magma that solidifies and that they weren't emplaced by tectonics.
So I noticed you almost said the Tobacco Mountains, right?
Yeah.
Yes. But that's another interesting place in Montana. Have you been there?
I have not personally been there, but a lot of the literature that I've been looking at has been from researchers that have done work in the Tobacco Roots just because they're very close. And a lot of like the Great Falls tectonic, that happened kind of, it fell under a bunch of mountain ranges. So, you know, the Tobacco Roots and the Rubies and then a couple other ones kind of all fell under the same stresses. So that's kind of why you can look at them and compare them.
And kind of going back to groundwater, what really interests you about groundwater? I mean, it's really important, obviously, for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So it's kind of funny. Last summer, I ended up working at my local municipal water department, and it was a summer job. I really didn't think anything of it. You know, I didn't, you know, whatever. I was painting fire hydrants, you know, going to different pump stations. And then I kind of realized that, you know, drinking water has a lot of chemistry, and I love chemistry. I love geology, but I also love chemistry. And I learned that drinking water has a lot to do with, you know, geology and chemistry and doing water sampling and, you know, learning about aquifers and the rocks that store the water. It's just, and it took my two interests and kind of put it directly into one thing. And, you know, working for the water department really kind of honed my interests. And I had some, you know, great opportunities to learn how, you know, drinking water is managed, you know, the different systems that they have in place. And it really spiked my interest.
So it's a lot more complicated than you may have assumed, or maybe even some listeners are assuming, like, oh, the water department, you know, you open up fire hydrants, right? Or you fix a pipe or something like that. And of course, people do that. But it's
water, especially in the American West, is going to get harder and harder to manage.
Yeah, that's definitely, especially in New England, we have, our water table is pretty high. You know, I hear stories about out here of, farmers especially having a really hard time. And I live on a farm, and, my family, we live on a horse farm, and we bale hay, and we're always pretty fortunate that, the seasons are usually pretty good. And, this isn't even a crop that we're living off of, we're usually pretty fortunate enough to have enough rain to be able to get hay in the barn and feed our animals. But I look at some of the farmers, out west, and it's just, it's heartbreaking that, they're struggling to be able to provide irrigation for their crops.
What are you seeing in terms of climate change in New England, especially as it relates to hydrology?
So I was actually talking to someone about this the other day. So in Boston, especially, a big thing that is a concern is sea level rise, because I don't know if you've ever seen photos or videos, but the seaport in Boston, if they get like a super high tide, it like goes underwater. Like you'll see chairs and picnic benches literally is completely underwater, just at a high enough tide. So that's definitely something that in the future that Boston and in many other cities, especially on the East Coast, are going to have to be aware of. The tides are rising, and it's not stopping anytime soon. So it's definitely something from an engineering and an environmental aspect that people really have to be aware of.
Are there, tell us a little bit about the Bridgewater and like how many students, and are there a lot of young people in the geology department? I mean, some like Eastern, there are some universities that don't even have graduate degrees in geology anymore, but it seems to be reattracting some young people.
Yeah. So our school's pretty small as far as Massachusetts state schools go. We have about close to 1200 students. Our department is actually probably one of the smaller departments on campus. We have about 40 students, and, we're very fortunate that our students that are there, they love geology and they love being involved. But we're primarily a teaching school. So a lot of students that come to Bridgewater, it's a 5-year program. So you go and you start your bachelor's, and then you end up with getting your master's so you can go out and teach. So a lot of the geology students that we see are actually double majoring in education as well as geology. So they will be getting, their master's in education, but also having a background to teach, things like earth science or geology.
So what is a difference between, say, earth science and pure geology? Obviously, geology is an aspect of that, but what else would you teach in earth science?
Well, it all really comes down to is, your degree audit, like what classes you have to take. I know for the earth science kids, for geology, I wish I took it because it sounds like a really interesting class, but we don't have to take meteorology. And meteorology is like one of the big classes that the earth science students take, because, you're looking at, you have to take bio classes because you're looking at the biosphere, the hydrosphere, the cryosphere. You're looking at all of it, not just the rocks.
And chemistry, how much chemistry? I mean, you could teach chemistry after you graduate, right? Because you as well as GL, if you wanted to do that.
Yeah, I believe so. Because you still have that, you have to take those core classes in chemistry. So you would have a background in chemistry.
You have a project, and that's why you came out west. What is the name of your project?
So the name of my project is the Geochemical Analysis of Ultramafic Bodies Within the Central Ruby Range of Southwestern Montana, Intrusive or Tectonic Emplacement. And that's just, like I said before, it's just we're trying to figure out, were these tectonic in nature or intrusive?
I was there yesterday and I was looking at a bunch of student projects, because everybody has this, all the students with the projects, and they have big posters and you go around and talk to people, and there's a lot of it that's above my head, but the titles just crack me up. They sound like going to a fancy restaurant where they're saying we're going to serve duck a la range with a little tad of cilantro and another little bit of thyme and with whipping cream on the top. You can get really fancy with some of these dishes. They don't tend to just name them. They have all of these little things in them. And that's what it kind of reminded me. So read the title again, please, for our listeners.
geochemical analysis of ultramafic bodies within the central Ruby Range of southwestern Montana, intrusive or tectonic emplacement.
Ultramafic?
So those are rocks that are containing a lot of minerals such as olivine or pyroxene. So the way it works is rocks are categorized. They're either ultramafic or felsic or intermediate, and it all depends on what minerals they have in them. So an ultramafic rock would have a lot of pyroxene or olivine, and then a mafic rock, which would be like a granite, would have a lot of, you know, feldspar and quartz and minerals like that.
So how long did you spend in the Rubies?
So went out for 10 days, did field work for 6 of those days. And we stayed at the University of Montana Southwestern, and we would every day would just, you know, get up, get in the car, and we would drive up into the mountains, and we'd look around for, you know, we drive along the road and we'd see, you know, oh, that outcrop kind of looks like a peridotite. And then we'd walk to it, and then more times than not, it wouldn't be a peridotite, but we were lucky in three of the times that we went out, we were able to find a pretty good peridotite outcrop.
What color is peridotite?
It's like kind of brownish black, kind of maybe a little bit of red in there too, but all these samples are really weathered. So they have lots of lichen on them. And the big thing that's super, you know, characteristic of these peridotites is we refer to it as having a knobby texture. And it basically looks like, you know, kind of almost looks like bumpy, almost like little bumps on it. So that's kind of when we look out in the field, you know, when you're trying to compare, you know, you don't always use color. So we use the texture, be like, oh, this rock is knobby. So, you know, it's probably a peridotite.
And what kind of analysis do you do? Do you do any analysis like immediately right at the spot? Or I assume you take it back to the lab and you do some analysis there. So can you just tell us about that a little bit, please?
So we do, when we were out there, we did, you know, field analysis, you know, taking, you know, the strike and dip of the different outcrops and just making detailed field notes about, you know, what we were seeing out there, you know, looking for contacts between the different rocks and just trying to paint a good picture to, you know, come back. You know, my professor, Dr. Kroll, who has been my mentor through this whole process, his biggest thing to us was take detailed field notes, because as soon as you get back to Massachusetts, you're not going to remember any of this.
It's a little far to just jump in your car and drive out and check on something in the field.
So when we were out there, you know, we take detailed field notes and, you know, we take measurements, we would measure the size of the outcrops. And then the real fun was when we were packing up about 20 boxes of rocks to send back to Massachusetts. The USPS was not very happy with us.
How much did that cost?
It was expensive. It was probably, I don't know exactly, but definitely I think close to $500, maybe a little bit more than that.
That might be a hazard of being a geologist, is having to mail rocks.
Oh, it was
one of the hazards.
And the worst part is, you know, even, you know, You're out there, you're writing by, you know, the address by hand. And, you know, if you mess up one wrong thing, like I had a box of rocks, you know, the zip code 02081. I must have messed up the number. And my box of rocks got sent to Springfield, New Jersey. So that was a big pain to get that back.
Yeah, that would have been fun to see the faces on the people who maybe opened the box.
Oh yeah. It got delivered to a house and everything. And I'm sure these people were probably like, what is this?
A box of rocks. Well, if you ever get a box of rocks, dear listeners, it's just a geologist with bad handwriting. Kind of like doctors, right? You have to have good handwriting to be a geologist. Yes. And so what's going to be the end result of this project? You have your poster. Is it like a paper that you have written up? Is it part of a thesis or what?
So this is just my undergraduate research. I would like in the future for this to become something bigger. I would, you know, love for a Bridgewater student in the future to take over and, you know, be able to build more off of what I already had, and, you know, go out to the Rubies and, you know, do more field work. And, you know, the big thing is collecting more samples and just trying to figure out where these outcrops are. And, you know, I think for me, you know, I've enjoyed what I've done, but I'm kind of ready to, you know, pass the baton to someone else. You know, it's been you know, a great experience. You know, I'm so excited to be out here for GSA and be able to present the work I have so far. We're still kind of, you know, there's no way to kind of point for sure. You know, we have a lot of evidence that supports both sides. So definitely future work for somebody would be kind of just finding more information and just being able to, you know, really kind of try and point towards one method of emplacement.
Well, that is kind of the nature of geology. I know geologists in the Northwest are still arguing about how, you know, most of Washington was an ocean at one time, and something smashed into something, and there's at least two theories of it. And so we, you know, we may not know, but I think what a great experience as a student, as a geologist student, to be able to do this work and to come to the Geological Society of America's meeting in Spokane. What have people been telling you about your poster and your work, like the professional geologists who've come around to look at it at the conference?
So we haven't had a ton of people coming up. Our presentation's at 4 today, so I'll be out there today. But reviews I have gotten from people. I had someone come up and was really nice about, I had some really nice photos of, thin sections, which are the rocks that are, you know, cut in half, and, certain rocks are really pretty colors. So I had, someone come up and tell me that my thin sections looked really pretty and that my poster was very thorough, and which meant a lot to me. And then I had someone else come up who was doing work in another part near the Rubies. So we were just talking about our experiences in the Rubies and, you know, different possibilities for my research. So it was very helpful just to hear from different people.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why everyone gets together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Julia, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's it.
Well, you did a great job. This is just off the cuff interview. And it might be slightly nerve wracking. And I think Julia needs a little bit of a drink of water.
Getting over cold today.
Right. Okay. And so thank you again for being on this sort of special edition of Earth Matters Now, sort of a random Thursday interview. We really appreciate your time. I'm going to pot it up for some more music because we have a couple more guests, more students, two of them, it looks like, in the lobby sitting outside the studio window. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
Sky, I can see. touch. I could feel your touch, Mother, in the sky. I can see you smile.
Had a little lady with me. sun had set and the stars in the sky were bright. I said, my little one, we better get you home for the night.
Andy Lee Ross from Project Censored, the news that didn't make the news. Tune in to Project Censored show every Monday at 4 p.m. right here on KYRS 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
Listening to Community Radio, KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm Laura Ackerman. I'm the host of Earth Matters Now, one of the co-hosts. And today, I'm just having a random interview session, but not with random people. I didn't pull them off the street. We have some Eastern Washington University geoscience students. We have Jerusha, Zach, and Aaron. And full disclosure, Jerusha is my daughter. She's also sometimes my co-host as a fill-in. They are part of a section meeting, what they call a section meeting, the Cordilleran Rocky Mountain section meeting of the Geological Society of America. It's been going on the 14th. It ends tomorrow, although I think there's some field trips on the 18th. And for us, for Earth Matters Now and for KYRS, that will culminate in the interview with Nick Zenter of Central Washington University. But meanwhile, I want to talk to some students. We just had Julia on from Bridgewater College in Massachusetts. So who do I want to start with first? Zach, I'm picking you. Okay. Right. welcome to KYRS Radio. Just tell us about the geosciences program at Eastern Washington University. And obviously that's from a student point of view.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm Zach. I am actually the president of the Geoscience Club at Eastern Washington University. we do a lot of outreach with the club. We kind of work with the department and have the support of the geoscience department. Pretty often go to Spokane schools and put on STEM nights and things like that to kind of get young people interested in the geosciences. But it's also just a great way for students to kind of all come together under this one umbrella of the geosciences, including students in GIS, students in geography, students in geology, and even hydrology, and just kind of hang out and like share our passion for the geological sciences together and do fun stuff like that.
How many students are there? Because it's only an undergrad program, right? It's, I shouldn't say only, but...
Right. So funny enough, last year there was a bunch of people graduated, and so the club was like super small. We started in the fall with only 3 members, and that's kind of how we fell into our officer positions. And just by doing a lot of outreach, we've, at least on paper, have grown the club to 57 members. There's about 30 active members based on who's reading emails and actually engaging with the club. And we probably have about 12 people show up regularly to meetings and things like that. So
what's your big interest in geology?
So I'm actually pretty interested in hydrology, and really like contamination and toxics of water resources. So everything from aquifers and groundwater to streams and, you know, lakes, tributaries, things like that. So basically my plan is I'm graduating this year. I plan to, I'll go to field camp, take the ASBOG, and I plan
to... tell listeners what the ASBOG is.
Sorry. the ASBOG, it's ASBOG. I cannot remember what that stands for.
But it's a test related to geology.
Yep. So, there's 2 parts to the test. And so the first one you take is called the FG, the Fundamentals of Geology. And you take that one, and then you need to get 5 years of experience working under a geologist, or 3 years of experience in a master's degree. And then you can go on and take what's called the PG, which is the Practice of Geology. And this is basically what you have to do to become a certified geologist. And there's even a test for, at least in Washington, to become a hydrologist or hydrogeologist. So lots of studying and, you know, just getting certified. And I mean, even today at the GSA, this has been an incredible opportunity for us. We got to speak to some actual hydrogeologists and professional scientists working in that field, and kind of learn a little bit about what it took for them to get where they're at now. And yeah, it's really, really valuable information. This has been an incredible opportunity as students at Eastern Washington to have the GSA meeting happen so close to home, mm-hmm. And especially to have our faculty involvement with it. Dr. Chad Pritchard is kind of organizing this regional meeting, and Nigel is also helping out with that as well, too. And so I feel very connected. It's been really cool.
And I've been there. I have had a press pass, and it's been really fun to talk to students and look at a lot of their projects. And Nigel will be on the show here in a few minutes, and we've had Chad on the show twice. He was here the other day, Wednesday, mm-hmm. kind of opened the show, at least for listeners, because most people in Spokane aren't going to be able to go to the show for various readings. So where are you from originally?
I was actually born in California, but I moved to Central Washington to a very small town called Royal City, Washington.
Oh, I know where Royal City, Washington is.
That warms my heart.
So been there many times. I grew up in Grant County.
Yeah, Grant County. There we go. 30 minutes or so south of Moses Lake. Went to high school there, and I actually, kind of fresh out of high school, I moved to Wenatchee. Did an AmeriCorps position all over the state, but I found it in Wenatchee, and I took that scholarship money from, they call it the Siegel Award, and I used that to move to Spokane, and shortly after that, transferred to Eastern, and yeah, so it was,
and you're graduating soon.
And I see the light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah. It is right there.
Excellent. Thank you. And Aaron, I'm going to pretty much ask you the same questions. Where are you from, first off?
So I'm originally from Colbert, Washington, which is just a little bit north of Spokane.
Yep, know where Colbert is. Most of our listeners do, I'm sure.
Okay, good. Sometimes I say I'm just from Spokane because some people don't know. But Yeah, that's where I'm originally from.
And what, have you been a student at Eastern your whole career? What year are you at Eastern?
So junior standing credit wise.
Okay.
It's been a little weird because out of high school, I did Running Start for 2 years. So I got my whole AA degree in high school. And then I went up to a college in Montana, in Bozeman, Montana, MSU. Mm-hmm. Went there for a semester and then came back home to work a little bit. And now I'm at Eastern, and this is my third quarter at Eastern. So I started in the fall.
What really interests you about geoscience in particular?
I like rocks.
You like rocks. I like rocks. That's kind of like my daughter. She likes rocks too.
I also really like how diverse the science is, and how it pulls from all the kind of like core sciences. Like, you need to understand physics, chemistry, and math to mm-hmm. really do well as a geologist. And also, you have to have the ability to critically think and to apply the knowledge you know or that you have seen to understand geologic systems. So I really enjoy it.
There's a lot of intersection with other disciplines in geology, you know, especially like paleobotany or biology, but certainly anthropology and geography and history, because so much of what happens on the landscape happens to some degree because of just the shape of rocks or the shape of water.
They do say geography is destiny.
Geography is destiny. Wow. Yeah. Do you think that's true?
I read a whole book on it.
So it must be true. There's a book written about it, right?
Yeah, obviously. I'm not really sure. The destiny of what? Like, in what way?
Right. That's a good question. You know, you look at the Spokane Falls, and certainly a lot of cities and towns are built on rivers for obvious reasons, right? But there's also a lot of displacement. There's displacement of indigenous people, which is what happened in Spokane and probably happened on every other river in the United States. There's a lot of industry often on rivers that takes place. Spokane's not really navigable in the sense, like, say, the Mississippi River is. But you also had just the built landscape. Wealthy people tend to like to live with views or on rivers or on lakes. And it does kind of create a certain destiny.
You could also look, I mean, just look at a mountain range, look at the Cascades, look how that divides Washington, not only like climate wise, but there's also a political divide between mm-hmm. like the East and West side mm-hmm. and all that.
Even though we belong to the Rocky Mountains and not the Cascades in this part of it, but you have a project, there's other, several other students. There's probably, I don't know how many of them, there's a few dozen of them, and they're not all just from Eastern Washington University. There's some Gonzaga students, and I think there's some Cal Poly students, and there were some from, Cal Poly.
It's all over. The West Coast states, the Rocky Mountain states, there's...
And the Cordillera.
Well, that's the West Coast.
The West Coast is the Cordillera. And so everyone has a poster, so you mm-hmm. that's put up, and people can come by and look at it, but you also have to give a presentation. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the way it works is if you have a research poster that was accepted by GSA, you set it up in the morning of your presentation day. So for me, my day was Thursday, today. So I set it up in the morning, and then from 4 to 5:30, I'll be by my poster to answer questions and kind of explain what's going on in it.
Well, tell us about your poster and your project. What did you do that you had to write your poster about?
So my research project was looking at PFAS variation through a wastewater facility treatment process. For those of you or your listeners who don't know, PFAS is like this emerging forever chemical that is probably pretty bad for us. I'm working on this fate and transport study with Dr. Chad Pritchard to figure out where PFAS is in the West Plains and kind of where it's going and where it's coming from.
Is that what you mean by fate and transport?
Yeah, so... the fate is like, where is it ending up? And the transport is like, how is it getting there? And that should help us get a kind of good idea of where it is in the environment, what we can then, you know, take steps to figure out, okay, what are we going to do about it?
But your project, the wastewater treatment mm-hmm. facility that you're talking about, that was where?
So, secret location.
Secret location. Okay, we won't. We thank you for telling me that. Okay, secret location.
Yeah, just, you know, PFAS is kind of a contentious issue. So there's a lot of people with, justifiably strong feelings about it. And, you know, this wastewater treatment plant hasn't, like, you know, if they potentially had accumulated PFAS, you know, you don't want a bunch of people going there and being like, you're poisoning my water. And mm-hmm. they're just, you know, they're not set up to handle it anyways.
It is indeed mm-hmm. a very political subject. Mike and I, who's my co-host, who couldn't be here today, we've talked a lot about it on the show. We've had Chad on the show and mm-hmm. the West Plains Water Coalition, and we're going to be hearing a lot about it. It's the West Plains is, I think, rather famous because of the PFAS, even though it's a worldwide problem.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so can you tell us a little bit more about the findings of the project without revealing anything that you're not supposed
yeah.
to?
Yeah. So what we found is, I'll give you a little background on how we sampled and kind of what we looked okay. for. So in the wastewater treatment plant, there's a couple processes that take your dirty, waste-filled water and turn it into clean effluent that can be discharged into the groundwater. So we sampled after the solids were separated from this wastewater. So, for our own personal comfort, so we don't have to deal with human waste. And we just deal with the liquid fraction of this waste. And then we sampled from a number of treatment steps. So this plant has a clarifier, which will kind of like decant the water. The bad stuff settles out to the bottom, and you kind of take the stuff you want off from the top. It has a second clarifier, has a sand filtration system, so kind of like a filter of sand, and then a UV light purification system. And then it's finally discharged as effluent, so like the water that leaves the plant into the groundwater. Those were the locations that we took samples from. And we found that these treatment steps had almost no effect on PFAS concentrations for better or for worse.
Hmm. That's interesting, because we know that those water filtration systems really impact in a good way
they do a number on the bad stuff in the water. But I mean, and it's kind of like understandable, because PFAS is very new and the plant really wouldn't be set up to handle that in any capacity.
I wonder if there is a wastewater treatment plant anywhere in the United States that is so new that it could deal with PFAS.
Well, I believe, I'm not completely sure about this, but Julia was saying that her plant does have some kind of treatment method in place to work with some of that water.
I've also heard, I believe the military base has kind of their own water system. And a lot of, like, PFAS, poly and perfluoroalkyl substances, they are used as fire suppressing, used in the production of fire suppressing chemicals and a number of other things too. Mm-hmm. But it has a lot of military application. And so nationwide, you'll find higher concentrations of PFAS contamination around military sites, usually.
Or airports.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of firefighting foam, because they're required by the federal government to do that. So is that something that you're going to work on when you graduate, since you're interested in groundwater?
I'm very, very interested in it. It's been a busy last couple quarters. I did try to kind of, I was thinking about hopping on one of these projects with Chad as well. I actually live in Airway Heights, mm-hmm. where a lot of the, I know he's done some groundwater sampling in the West Plains area up there. I mean, even from a personal standpoint, when I moved there, I immediately installed a reverse osmosis drinking water filter because I was like, this is the best that I can do. Like, I don't want to drink this water. I mean, Airway Heights is no longer pulling drinking water from their aquifers there. I believe they're actually bringing it in from Spokane, from a separate aquifer that's not contaminated. But I was just thinking about pipes and faucets and things that PFAS might possibly stick to, and I didn't want to be drinking that. So,
how much did that cost you?
Oh, the filtration system? Ooh, maybe 300-ish or something like that. I mean, you have to replace the filters every 6 months or so, and they're about $80 to replace them. So,
and so they would just get incinerated then, because that's how we deal with our garbage in Spokane County.
Right.
Right. And then all of, because our garbage is toxic, and it's not just because of the PFAS filters, it's being dioxin. And so they take the ash and they rail it to a special dump in Klickitat County, I think.
Yep.
Yeah.
I do know in regards to filters, you know, at the last like public meeting on West Plains related issues that I went to, you know, you can get, you know, little small, like, you know, under the sink filters that'll be on like a faucet or something mm-hmm. like that. But really, your only other option is you can get like entire
whole house
systems, and they cost like $50,000 because they have to be completely engineered for your house, and mm-hmm. they have to look at the water chemistry and some stuff like that. And that was something that was talked about a lot at this meeting. And there isn't really any sort of like intermediate filtration system. So it's either like you get these small ones and you can put them on like each faucet, or, you know, get a whole house one that and spend tens of thousands of dollars.
Well, because if you have livestock, you don't want to be feeding them PFAS water, or even growing a vegetable garden or having fruit trees. You want to have mm-hmm. good water, because that can impact you. That can impact your health. Yeah. So, Aaron, are you interested in groundwater too? Has this piqued your interest, or is there? But you said you like rocks, so. Mm-hmm. You probably will stay with rocks, you think?
Well, there's a reason I'm on the project.
Okay, and what's that?
I really enjoy like water sampling and learning about hydrology in general, and it's a really enjoyable project. My focus in school, well, I mean, I'm still kind of figuring it out of what exactly I want, but I've really enjoyed mineralogy and petrology. But we'll see, because, you know, what you learn in school is different than maybe what you do in a job.
Well, that's the value of doing a project like this.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And you get a lot of, just this practical experience. And it might even make you more sellable, if you want to use that term, in terms of finding a job, mm-hmm. because you've had this. And I think probably a good thing about an undergraduate program without a graduate program is you get a lot of attention from your professors, because they don't have graduate students.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely one of the advantages of the program at Eastern, is that attention to students.
Yeah, and that that can really make a difference. And Jerusha, my daughter, is here. You're not presenting. You didn't have a project of sorts, but it didn't end up at GSA,
well,
right?
I did do a project, but it wasn't done, none of like the sampling and all that. It was done after the deadline for GSA submissions. But, you know, I got to present it at the Eastern Symposium last week, and actually Aaron and I are both going to have our posters at a Spokane River event mm-hmm. in the end of this month. But I'm on the same project as Aaron, actually, and I did a poster looking at the West Plains surface waters, because that's just part of the whole, you know, PFAS fate and transport study is, you know, we know the groundwater is, the contamination there is, you know, it's pretty significant and widespread. But there really hadn't been any sampling done on surface waters. I know in 2016, like West Medical Lake and one area place in the Spokane River had been sampled by Department of Ecology. But other than that, we sampled a bunch of other locations that have probably never, ever been sampled for PFAS.
So how many more is on the agenda to sample for PFAS through Eastern's project?
Well, we did a few lakes. We have, we did West Medical Lake also. We did Medical Lake, Silver Lake, Willow Lake, mostly because those lakes, they're kind of at the southwest corner of the West Plains, and the water from those lakes kind of flows to the northeast, like a lot of the groundwater. So that's kind of part of understanding like the fate and transport. And we did Marshall Creek, Latah Creek, did some springs, and then we did like four locations along the Spokane River. And we're going to actually, part of the PFAS fate and transport study is we have a bunch of these locations, the surface water locations, and then other groundwater locations, and they're going to be sampled quarterly, so every season. And we're going
to
just see.
Why do you have to do it seasonally?
Well, see if there is any sort of fluctuation in PFAS variation throughout the season. And that can also give you some indication into where some of the water in these water bodies is coming from. Or like, so if you have, you know, so for example, the Department of Ecology studies in 2016, they did the Spokane River. They did it in the spring and the fall. And they actually did a number of other locations around the state. And a lot of those locations, they were higher in the fall than in the spring. And so there's a lot of factors that can kind of go in to that. Like, are these surface water bodies, are they being like fed by contaminated groundwater or something like that? Is there, we know there is, you know, like PFAS in the rain and the snow. What factors, you know, how much does that add into the, you know, how much does that factor into the contamination levels you're finding in these surface water bodies? And then you're looking at even just the types of PFAS compounds that you're finding. You have like longer chain ones, so like the chains of carbon, and you have some shorter chain ones. And you can look at like the longer chain ones you're more likely to find in, like, they accumulate in like sediment. So if the water is levels like raising or lowering, are some of those just getting more locked up in the sediment? And so, you know, will your level go down, or is there like some other source of PFAS contamination that's like flowing into this water body and potentially, you know, making that, what am I trying to say? I can talk about this forever, but, you know, it's just a lot of different factors.
It's really complex.
Just, and
yeah.
Yeah, I know. And it's like, we just don't know a lot. That's kind of the hard thing is, you know, there's been some other studies, you know, on PFAS that have looked at like differences between like water and sediment. But every location is going to be so different. Every place has a unique hydrogeology. And so you can get a lot of, you know, you just have to go to each individual location and figure out like what's specifically going on. And so that's why, you know, in the West Plains, we want to do the quarterly sampling to see what factors may be contributing to PFAS variation throughout.
So the PFAS issue is really also politically charged.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, you know, sort of pun intended, because you have aquifers that are charged and recharged. But like on the West Plains, where it's really challenging because you have this really interesting mixture of private wells and public water. And mm-hmm. there's perception about private wells and perception about public water. And I have a well on the farm that I live in that was started in 1910. I have like senior water rights. And I think I'm okay with PFAS, but I don't know that for sure. It's starting to make me a little nervous. I'm going to have the well tested. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're going to be dealing with, Zach? Is in hydrology? Are you interested in the PFAS issues?
Yeah, so I am interested in it. And like public outreach and like, what is the word they call it? Just kind of having to interact with the public.
Engagement.
Yeah, engagement. That is a huge part of the job, depending on what you're doing. I mean, a lot of the professionals that I was talking to today even spoke about, you know, if you are like a grad student and you want to research some of these things, people might be more willing to let you come out and test their water. But, you know, when you work for the federal government and you have some letters of the alphabet across your chest or something, like people might be a little bit more suspicious. And so it is very politically charged. I'm very interested in doing field work. I don't know if I'm going to be wanting to go more private or more federal government jobs. There's kind of pros and cons to both. I have a buddy who has kind of, he went to Montana Tech and he has kind of seen both sides of that. And he says he sleeps a lot easier working for the private sector. So, I think there's kind of trade-offs, but, definitely just the other day, this PFAS thing has been going on for a while, but it's really just starting to gather steam, mm-hmm. And get a lot more public awareness. But just the other day, I happened to stumble upon a movie called Dark Waters. It's a Mark Ruffalo movie, and this is the issue that they're talking about. In the movie, they call it C8, and it directly relates to what Jerusha was just talking about the long carbon chains and shorter carbon chains of these PFAS substances. But it's a little bit dramatized, but I think it gives like a good public perception of like kind of what this is all about. Because it can be very complex.
It's complex. It's and part of that is the politics of it. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting as a well owner for 26 years, but living in the city before that and having city water. And when I moved out to the West Plains, and just from my dad's relatives from Idaho, you know, a lot of people have wells and they like them because it's private water, mm-hmm. and it can't be controlled, or you know, you don't have to do anything, or it's not going to be contaminated by something in most cases, simply because it's private, because that is the perception of wells. Whereas public water, and I think a lot of that just depends on your political views, you know, public water is actually tested frequently. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting perspective. And then also now we've had to send water for the, you know, the Rathdrum Prairie Aquifer, Spokane Aquifer, which is a sole source drinking aquifer, as I'm sure you know, out to Arroway Heights. And as the city expands and the growth management boundary expands, you can't really put an apartment complex on a well. So you have to have public water. And where does it come from? It's all coming from the, you know, our sole source drinking aquifer. And then you have that importation of water, mm-hmm. and then you have more water management in terms of your aquifer. And there's other host of interesting things that have happened and will happen in the future. Do any of you have any comments on that?
Nigel has this great quote in his email string. It's like a tag at the end of his email string. And I don't remember who it's from, but it says, "Civilization exists by geologic consent." And so just like what you were talking about, where we have this perception of, you know, this is my private well, as long as I don't contaminate it, it's going to be just fine. But what's really happening is that well is attached to an aquifer and it's discharging from that aquifer that might be under the ground on somebody else's land that they might happen to be dumping chemicals on the ground, you know, or agriculture could even play a role into it. There's so many things that could potentially affect groundwater resources. This is what I'm so interested about. And, you know, we have ways of determining how contaminants move through different host rocks and different aquifers, depending on, you know, is it an artisanal water, artisanal aquifer or a confined aquifer or unconfined? What is the porosity and the flow rate and things like that? And it's really good that we're now starting to get eyes on this kind of contamination problem, that it's becoming sort of a buzzword. I mean, I'm hearing people all over the place talk about PFAS, and it's really exciting. But at the same time, it's like, this is a huge issue. And so,
Air and water are not private.
Right.
You can try and make them private, but it doesn't work that well. And just to give you an example, the farm that I live on was started in 1910 by the Siegert family. And next to probably 80 of my feet, I can walk from my house to the middle of a vernal pool, but it used to be a permanent pond. But it's all basalt out on the West Plains, or practically all basalt. The house that I live on, they just sheared the basalt off of it and built the house on top of it.
Oh, wow.
Which you wouldn't probably be able to do today. But when they built the interstate, I-90, mm-hmm. the pond drained in 3 days. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other people lost wells that east of where I live. And it really messed up the water table in that part of the West Plains. And of course, maybe people didn't think about that, but I think Nick Zentner describes it as a German chocolate cake, those layers of basalt. And that's another complicating factor.
Well, that's a thing, you know, even with like hydrogeology, is the rocks are important in that. As well, the West Plains, looking at the the basalt, you know, it makes it very, you know, really interesting in terms of where the groundwater is flowing and all that because, of, you know, of how it's like all fractured and stuff like that for sure.
So, Aaron, what are some of your favorite rocks? What would interest you if you were a rock geologist, for lack of a better term?
A rock geologist? Hmm. That's what geology is. Is rock.
Right.
It's like picking your favorite kid. Like.
Yeah, I know, but right? But in theory, rocks don't get jealous of each other like children do. But okay, so give me some of your, what I said, you know, rocks with a plural. What do you, mm-hmm. what really interests you and why?
Kind of interestingly, the thing that interests me most about rocks is what rocks are made of. So minerals, mm-hmm. really. It's just a really fascinating thing to me how elements can come together and then form these ordered atomic structures with different properties and different colors and shapes. It's just really unique to me. And then also how they, you know, when a rock forms, all these different minerals bind together to make some thing with some unique properties. Just really unique to me. I really like, we call them ultramafic rocks. So
you'll have to explain that term.
Yeah, of course. There's this compound called silica. It's silicone and four oxygens. They form these little tetrahedrons, so like kind of 3D triangles, basically. And these pieces of silica will kind of change a rock's properties dominantly. So at least in igneous rocks, it gets metamorphic rocks are more complicated, and then sedimentary rocks are insane to me. But so igneous rocks that come from lava or magma. So depending on the silica content, there'll be a variety of rocks. Ultramafic rocks have very low silica content, which means that they cool at relatively high temperatures. So, and they're very hot when they reach the surface, if they do at all. So, like if you look at your Hawaiian lava, for example, that's an example of mafic lava. It's very hot. It's very runny because there's not a lot of silica. Felsic lava, on the other hand, that's kind of like your opposite end of the spectrum, is very explosive. So Mount St. Helens, that was felsic lava that exploded. Ultramafic rocks are kind of this very unique, extremely low silica, even more so than mafic rocks, rock that used to form on the Earth's surface but now doesn't because the Earth is actually too cool for ultramafic rocks to reach the surface. And they contain a number of rare minerals, like a mineral called olivine, pyroxene, just some very interesting rocks, stuff you don't usually see, and that's why it's interesting to me.
And there was, last month, I think, there was a rock and mineral show or a gem show, and those, mm-hmm. I think, are quite common. I know there's one in Tucson that's extremely famous. People have all these really cool things, and they make art out of them. But
that's where the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show is, where the Spokane Gem and Mineral Show people get their rocks to resell.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that does happen. Yeah. Yes, and just like, I mean, that happens. You hear of backyard dog breeding. I mean, it happens in the chicken world. I happen to keep chickens, and but
backyard rock breeding?
Backyard rock breeding. Although I'm sure there are people who would fall for that, right? You guys are all too young to remember the pet rock craze of the 1970s. You'll have to...
People still have them.
I suppose, yes. They were literally selling rocks and in stores, and you could get one. You could buy a pet rock. I don't know who came up with it. It didn't last that long, but people bought them.
I bet someone made a lot of money.
Yeah, they made their fortune and took off.
In pet rocks.
Those like they had the kits that you would like put googly eyes on it and stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you had that option and you could name them. Anyway, they are cheaper though than pet dogs or anything else.
Yeah. Or children,
yes. So what about the ethics of collecting rocks and minerals? I don't know how much that's talked about in the geological world, but it seems to me it might have to be.
In mining?
Not even talking about mining. I'm just talking about, I'm a collector and I'm just going to take, mm-hmm. 300 rocks from this outcropping because people like them and I can sell them for, whatever per rock.
That's a really hard situation because a lot of, some people will not, don't really have very good ethics for collecting rocks. So I've heard a number of stories from my professors of them taking students to locations where there were, you know, unique minerals. And then over time, those students just kept taking rocks and depleted the area mm-hmm. of those resources.
Mm-hmm. And that happens with plants and animals too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of the really interesting outcrops that the general public might see happen to be in national parks, like Yellowstone or Yosemite, for example. And you are definitely not supposed to take mm-hmm. rocks from those places. People do. But, I mean, yeah, it's like you were saying, Aaron, you know, it seems like a small thing, but over time, if you're bringing a group out every year and they're picking all the garnets out of the rock garden there, pretty soon there's not going to be any more for the next class that comes or for anybody that comes.
Right. Yeah. And that happens obviously with fossils. That's well known mm-hmm. in the world, and it probably still does happen. But as a geologist, there might be times where you're out in the field and you have to get your rock pick out. I think that's what they call it, mm-hmm. you know, and chip off a piece and look at it and just to get a better idea of what it was. And then some things have to be sampled in the lab with tests. Mm-hmm. But you know, you still maybe don't want to do that in a national park, even if you are a scientist. And I think you might have to have explicit permission from the National Park Service.
Well, and they would have like their own science, you know, science. I don't know all about the National Park Service, but you know, there are scientists that work there and conducting research in a national park. I mean, you're definitely going through some sort of like permitting process, and there's probably certain ethics. And it's not, you know, you can obviously, I don't know if, you know, if people have looked into like if how common, you know, taking things from national parks is. But I think in a lot of cases it's pretty, things can be pretty well protected. I don't know. I think, you know, developing, I think, you know, people just have like different ethics, like when they're in a national park right. versus when they're, you know, out just somewhere on a random trail and it's like, oh, here's a cool.
Right. One won't hurt. Yeah. But mm-hmm. I think for all professionals, there's in a lot of professions, there's protocols that are written, you know, because ethics, I think, is going to become, it's just more and more of a challenge in the world for a lot of reasons. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. In geologic research, generally, you're not taking a large, well, you know, a relatively speaking, large amount of rock. Right. You're mm-hmm. taking, I don't know, maybe like a couple sample bags full, you know, enough to fill up a little backpack. And then that's what you do your research on, you know, crush them up, do your geochemical analysis or whatever, you know. Or you're just looking at like your samples in the field. But I think it definitely is a problem when people, you know, in popular hiking areas or in popular nature areas, you know, you don't really think about how taking that little rock might affect the area. But, you know, imagine thousands of people over hundreds of years taking these pieces of the environment from there.
And we've seen that happen.
Yeah. I think, like, as I've sort of grown to love geology, but like in the beginning, I thought it was so funny how we would go out to outcrops and this is something that I used to do to like a friend while we were backpacking just as a prank, like slip a couple rocks in their bag while they're hiking and I'm behind them. So that at the end of the day, they're like, man, my pack is so heavy. And now I'm that guy who's intentionally putting rocks in my bag as I'm sampling, like things that I will later use in projects or whatever. And so, you know how the tables turn.
Right. And it totally like depends on the rock, like around here, it's like a lot of basalt. I don't think people are taking basalt, you know.
No, but you see some pretty basalt.
No, well, you, I mean, landscaping. You see like big. Oh, yeah. But you know, you can't take a landscape home.
They'll come find you.
One of my professors tried.
But you know, the Spokane International Airport. There's basalt columns when you drive to the airport, at least from the east side. Now, I'm assuming they got permission, or they could get it off private property too.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of like basalt quarries and stuff like that. I mean, when you look at just mining and mineral resources in general, I mean, rock, just nice like rock and gravel is like sand is the most commonly used, you know, mined resource. And it's not like, you know, there's like a rock shortage in the world exactly. Right, it's just, I think, yeah, when you look at the ethics of taking rocks, a lot of times it'll be just these really, really beautiful outcrops. It'll be somewhere where people can find gemstones or fossils or something like that. And that's, I think, definitely where you see a lot of the issues. Or you get like rock hounds, you know, they find... Well, a lot of them are like, they like to keep their places secret. But if it becomes publicized, then, you know, that can... Yeah.
Right. And sand, I think, is on the decline in the world. We're using up a whole lot of sand for construction in the world.
Mm. Yeah. I think with that ethics portion as well, rarity is a really important concept. Because, you know, if I'm taking a piece of basalt from a basalt column, it's not going to do much. And you might honestly... weathering and erosion is also something to mm-hmm. consider, because these processes are going to happen naturally at these exposed outcrops. But when you start to think about taking minerals that you had to dig into the earth to find, or these rare things that don't commonly form, then
it's right. another story. Well, there's another good example of geology as destiny. I mean, you look at copper mines, gold mines, diamond mines, mm-hmm. coal well, mines.
And that's the thing too, is like, you know, mineral resources, they're in everything and everywhere. I mean, we rely on them, so you have to have some, you know, minerals to a certain degree. But like, that's, I mean, it is, I think mining is a kind of a tough issue, because a lot of the mine resources are non-renewable. So it's, yeah, I mean, that's, it's a really like complex issue, because it's like, we need these, but, you know, are they going to last forever?
Yeah, that's not when you got to start mining asteroids.
I'm sure someone has a plan for that. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I recently did a project on the Central African Copper Belt, and there's so much to this particular area. It's where essentially 90% of the cobalt in the world comes from, because mm-hmm. it's called the Copper Belt, but cobalt is also... strata bound within the same formations. And I ended up initially I was thinking I was going to do this project sort of as an overview of how did the copper get here? How did the cobalt get here? And then, you know, a little blurb about why it's important. And then I was going to have a completely other side to the project on the ethics of it, because, you guys have probably heard about, mining in the Congo and, just poor working conditions, and even, you know, children working in mines mm-hmm. with no safety equipment and things like that. And it just snowballed. I mean, it was starting to become such a huge thing on the ethics side for my research that I was like, I think I need to narrow this down. And I really just kind of drilled in the science of how this formation formed, instead of going on the ethics side of it, just because it can be so complicated and broad.
Yeah. And there are there are human rights groups that are watching that issue. There's a lot of them, because there's a lot of, and that happens in forestry as well, not just in, you know, in mines. And and just the whole fossil fuel issue, the ethics mm-hmm. of that. And that's certainly something that, geologists, if you become a geologist and you can move on, you could work for oil companies, and that might be an ethical question for some people who are geologists. Maybe mm-hmm. it, you know, obviously it isn't for some people, but it could be for other people, and you don't necessarily go into that part of the geology of it, you know, at that level. I think you have to have like a PhD if you want to work for an oil company.
They hire it, yeah, well, there's a lot, they hire a lot.
Yeah, that is something. I mean, if you want to do I think that's an ethical question. I would see it personally as one, and you know, it's, but there are probably people that don't.
You know, I'm actually double majoring, and my first major, like my first goal at Eastern, was just to do environmental science. Mm-hmm. And I have this great professor named Dr. Carmen Nezat. She really kind of helped me figure out what it was that I was interested in. And so I ended up deciding to, I ended up deciding to focus on geology under that environmental science degree. And then she pushed me to do the double major to do geology as well. Yeah. And so in those early days, I was very much, kind of on that side of, you know, is this ethically okay, like mining geology, things like that. and I had my own opinions about it. But in some ways, like, as I've learned more, things are so complicated and complex, and I don't necessarily think it's always kind of like evil empire type things going on. I mean, we really, fossil fuels are what we use for energy, and we don't have a great alternative right now. I mean, obviously we're trying to transition into renewable energy, but there's a host of issues with that as well, and especially things that are, you know, battery electric, if we want to talk about like battery powered cars and things like that. There's a lot that goes into it. I mean, when we talk about the emissions of a gas-powered vehicle, it's like parking the gas-powered vehicle into a contained box and turning it on and testing how much carbon emissions come out of that. When we do that for an electric vehicle, it's going to show zero carbon emissions, but that's not the full picture because of the mining associated with attaining the rare earth metals and everything that goes into those batteries, the coal burning power plants that recharge those batteries, things like that. So it's, we're not fully off of fossil fuels, even if we want to be. And I think until that technology like continues, I don't see it as ethically wrong to be working in the oil and gas industry or mining geology and things like that. Obviously, we, you know, those who know better do better. So we know better now, and we need to do better. And there's a lot of things that have to change worldwide in terms of ethics.
Right. We don't, have coal in the Northwest, so that, you know, the power for our electric cars, if people buy them, comes from
hydroelectric dams.
Mm-hmm. And also some wind and
right.
You know, and obviously there are going to be people that disagree with you, Zach, and
sure.
That's what is, I think you're referring to, is what makes it so complex. And certainly electric, I mean, there's mining that goes on with general internal combustion engines. You have to mine for that as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really tough. It's probably rewarding. I think it's a lot of work to study to be a geologist. But yeah, there's ethics, especially for all the three of you who are much younger than I am. There are going to be a lot of challenges in the world for you as not only as citizens of the world and as humans, but also as geologists. So I'm still hoping that Nigel Davies from Eastern Washington University will be here. I haven't seen him yet, but I appreciate the three of you coming in, Jerusha, Zach, and Aaron, geoscience students at Eastern Washington University. Congratulations to you, Zach. You're going to graduate here.
Thank you.
Pretty quickly. And I think Jerusha and Aaron have another year, year and a half or so.
I'm 2 more years.
I'm just because
I'm enjoying.
Enjoying it. And then, like you said, you know, we should double major, Zach, or you should take some extra chemistry, Jerusha, or some extra this, yeah. Aaron.
I'm going to have to do some extra chemistry.
Extra chemistry, yeah, because it's just, there's that other intersection between chemistry and geology. I mean, you really have to know a little bit about it. And so it's a more complex major than I kind of ever realized, because if you say I'm a geologist and then the person next to you says, oh, well, I'm a physicist, and people go, ooh, physicist, you're so smart, right?
You know, it's more than just looking at pretty rocks all day.
Looking at pretty rocks all day, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, if any of your listeners ever have the chance to go to a GSA conference, your mind will be blown. It will start leaking out your ears because the material is just so dense. Like, this science is very complex, more so than you would ever imagine.
And everybody, you know, a lot of people, they kind of find their own particular niche within geology. And you know, there's some things, going to some presentations, like, okay, I can kind of follow this. And there's some things, and it's like, I've never heard of this. I don't know, I'm sitting in a room with like 40, 50 people. It's like, you kind of wonder, like, probably a lot of these people don't really know what's going on. Because people just get into like their very specific research, a very, very niche area. And it's like, they're like maybe the only person who really knows about that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Any last words?
thank you so much for having us on. This was great. Of course.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. I know I had to drag you away from the conference. Fortunately, it's not very far to walk because it's just down at one of the hotels downtown. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you listeners tuning in on this sort of random interviews about geology on Earth Matters Now. It's sort of a special Earth Matters Now. And you are listening to Community Radio, KYRS. Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm Laura Ackerman, and back to the music.